Okay?
I lost my pen. My pen is gone. No, I left it right here.
Well, we will reconvene the public meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. This is the afternoon satiation protection program presentation to this afternoon. We will waive the rule I just read, and if any member of the public has any comments to make or questions to raise at any time, I'll be pleased to recognize you. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, we might make it might be appropriate. We went over the committee member comments, and it might be appropriate to hear a couple comments just for purposes of the record and our audience of the about the tour this morning.
That's a good idea. We had the largest single tour that I can recall, large bus, and filled it up.
I think we had 48 members of the public.
Okay, Rob. Go ahead.
That's all.
I thought you were going to read some comments.
No. No, I was not. I just thought comments that the members might have if they had any about the tour.
Well, Bill was concerned about the U-boats.
I just mentioned that, again, we appreciate the opportunity to get all the way up to observe the construction at the IFC site, and I think it was a very good idea to bring the bus through there so that people could see what's happening, and I'd hope that we can continue to do that with the future public tours. And since we're still seeing strong interest in those tours, I recommend that we continue them as long as we continue to fill them with people who are interested in seeing the plant and learning more about it.
And even if we don't quite.
Dave, the feedback I got from members of the public is they were very appreciative of having this opportunity. And as Perry just said, they hope we can continue doing that.
Yeah. Sheila, anything that you want to say about this morning?
I thought the people were grateful and certainly interested.
I thought the tour went very, very well. I wanted to particularly compliment the ops training individual who briefed the section of the bus that included myself. I thought he did a very thorough job, and I think he carefully explained how people get to become licensed nuclear operators. I just thought he did a real fine job. And I think people were very appreciative of being able to go up and look at the independent facility that's in the construction up on top. We spent enough time there, I think, such that everybody on the bus got an opportunity to take a look at what the progress was associated with that. And
we're significantly better than they had been in the past, so I let Ellie know that.
I did too.
And we did everything I wanted to do with one exception, and that is visit the overlook and have our little briefing overlooking the plant. But I understand either our large number or the construction prevented that.
Active construction, I think, was the issue.
And the fog. So
the fog.
Too well, anyway.
I would try to get that overlook back in our tour if possible.
Yeah, I think you get the sense of what we're saying. It was one of the best tours that I can remember. One problem that maybe there's a resolution to it, maybe there isn't. Security takes a long time. And we really ran into that with the large bus load and one guard with a bin of badges. And he would call a name, and he'd be in the front row and hand him his badge. Call another name, he'd be in the back. The next guy would be in the front. And people were kidding about finding a better way to do that. Mm-hmm. And maybe somebody will come up with one, because that in itself took 10, 12 minutes. And if you add that, the amount of time the bus was sitting there waiting for him to get on and waiting for other guys to look around the bus, a quarter of an hour went by, which we really lost as far as useful time to hear things. And I know you can't blame the security guys because they were doing the best they could, but there may be some way we can speed up the badging process, and if somebody give that some thought, that would be good.
One thought might be to go ahead and have the badges distributed when the bus is riding from the visitor center over to the security area and then have the guards confirm that each person has ID that matches their badge. And that way they'd be distributed and they could just go down the bus and do the ID checks.
Right.
And so we do have some requirements there, but what I can do is take back the fact that there could be more efficient ways to handle that part of the process, and we'll take a look at that.
Good.
Thanks for the feedback.
Okay. Then let's turn it over to you, and
okay.
We'll go on the agenda.
All right. So our first presentation for this afternoon is our Nexus project status, and and that's a software upgrade that we're doing. And with us this afternoon is Charlie Nichols, and Charlie is our project manager. Yesterday about ESOM, so they have some familiarity with the product and the functionality, but they may have additional questions.
Yeah, we'll talk about how we're implementing. Good, thanks. So quickly, the status of the project is as follows. ESOMs, we've started training on schedule. We go live August 28th with that product.
Charlie, come up, pull up that microphone.
I don't know if I can do that. How's that? See, you're okay?
Yeah,
thanks. So ESOMs clearance, we're on schedule. We started training. We're going to go live with that on August 28th. On the SAP side, we're in unit testing, which is the first level of testing that you'd encounter in an SAP project as you finish development and moving it forward to production. We've also revised a readiness procedure, and some of you, when you came out for fact-finding, talked about the readiness procedure, which is our change management approach, and we'll talk in detail about that towards the end. We've revised the readiness procedure to reflect the go-live date of the SAP side in June 30th of 2007.
On ESOMs, who gets training? I'm thinking ops and maintenance. Who beyond that?
Ops, maintenance, anyone that's qualified for, anybody that has a qualification requires it. Some people you might think of would be the area of contract managers. They require clearance training as part of their quals. So there's several hundred people that we're training. The operators clearly would have the most rigorous training. JPMs are involved and so forth. That started in June, goes all the way through the end of August.
Typically, how much would an operator, what's the max an operator would have to be trained?
Furman, I have to beg a little forgiveness. I believe it's about 10 hours. Okay, a standard worker in the plant gets a two-hour training. On the screen, the operators get hands-on training on keyboard.
Okay.
Milestones for the project. At a high level, the project milestones are to move first on the SAP side into what we call a business transformation development environment. It's significant because Diablo Canyon is joining the project known as business transformation with the rest of the utility. The rest of the utility has several projects in progress that also build on SAP. So this allows Diablo Canyon's project and the other projects to test together and to make sure that they work collectively when we all go live. Okay, so that's actually done. We are now working alongside of business transformation. That happened in the last month. We go live August 28th for ESOMs. We start end-user training for SAP on February 19th of 2007.
Okay. ESOMs, when did you say?
We go live with ESOMs on August 28th of this year.
August.
Yeah.
Charlie, while you're on that subject.
In the meantime, we're building clearances on the T-week countdown. Make sense?
In that three-week period, you're not using PIMS and you're not using ESOMs. Is it all a manual process?
No. We're starting to build. We start building 3 weeks ahead. We start building in ESOMs and working in PIMS. So it's an overlap time.
I understand. Okay. Got it.
That's kind of how you roll one and phase one out and the other one in. That's what it amounts to. On the SAP side, again, we start end-user training February 19th of 2007. Integration testing completes on March the 30th of 2007. We complete our end-user training on June 29th, and we go live on June the 30th of 2007. Again, high-level milestones. You can imagine there's a very detailed schedule that underlies all of these milestones.
Charlie, what made you push go live with the SAP module out a year?
There's two significant reasons, and I've got a slide on those.
Okay.
But let me tell you what they are. One is around interfacing to our scheduling, and one is around data conversion. Okay, and a little bit later, I've got a slide and we can talk in detail about that.
But it is just about a year, right?
It's 10 months. And the reason for 10 months is that it drops into a window after our next refueling outage and before the one following it. Yeah. So, you know, we chose a time not so much to support the project needs as to support the plant needs.
I understand. Thank you.
ESOMS, a little bit about this, and you may have covered it already. ESOMS is a suite of software. So ESOMS does more than just clearances, although we're going to start with clearances in August. That also has tag sharing, configuration control. They support the clearance module. In the future, we'll change out our operator narrative rounds and logs, and then out in 2007, along with the SAP Go Live, we'll implement the tech spec tracking piece. So ESOMS does a couple of other things that we don't do in SAP. ESOMS much better tailored to the nuclear world in this area. Okay. Next slide.
Charlie, one more question on ESOMS. I know it's computer-based and works with your SAP software. Is ESOMS to the point where an operator can carry a PDA or other portable device to log or take care of tags?
It can be. It can be. In our initial rollout, it won't be. The operator, the narrative logs and rounds is that piece. And if we go far forward in the future, it can be enabled with, you know, handheld devices. That's not part of our project, but it's got the capability.
Okay. Thank you.
So, and that can all be interfaced, all mixed together. Next up, ESOMS milestones, just kind of, I'm sure we'll hit this a lot since it's a project that, piece of project we're doing now. Again, I told you training started on June the 14th, system testing.
On ESOMS, Charlie, do you have experience from any other stations about the transition, phasing out and phasing in?
Absolutely. In fact, the guy who's the person who's the project lead went to another power plant, and forgive me, I'm coming up blank.
Cooper.
I want to say, not Cooper, I think
not
Surrey, watched an outage in ESOMS, brought that back. We've also had the consulting company, the company that owns the software, bring their people on site. They've done this at several nuclear plants. Done a lot of benchmarking and lessons learned. We've also brought OE into the classroom as part of our training. So, yeah, a great deal of lessons learned. And actually taking solutions to the configuration from other plants. So a great deal of that. Sheila, you asked about why we moved our schedule out. Data conversion is one of the issues. Where we are with that today is the mapping between PIMS, our legacy system, and SAP. That's the field-by-field location in the new system from the old system. That's completed. We've done the process map or the field-level mapping. We're working on the extraction and the translation programs. That means it comes out of the old system. It gets some amount of change done to the data sometimes. Sometimes it's a one-for-one. And then it becomes a load into the new system. So the extraction and translation are computer programs, sometimes in SAP, sometimes in the legacy system, PIMS. And those all need to be tested. So they're small programs that accomplish that work. That's going on now. Then we do load testing and essentially full data conversion loads and test it iteratively to the point where it works completely.
PIMS is written in COBOL, right?
Correct.
So is this challenging to do this? Or?
I'll be honest with you, it's not challenging because we have great COBOL programmers. If we didn't, it would be. So, yeah, it's an old system. We've got some tremendous resources at the plant, been there for years, and we've married them up with SAP resources and done some cross-training. So feel very good about it. The challenge really is the amount of work that there is. It's just a lot of data. As you can imagine, we've got 20 years of PIMS data. And scheduling interface, I mentioned that as a major issue. Our scheduling software is Primavera's P3 Echo, P3 Enterprise version. We've had issues in the interface between SAP and P3 and back to SAP, primarily in time. It's a time amount of time it takes to move the data from one to the other and back. Okay? We're still working on that. This month we should complete the business requirements. We back to the business several times to ensure we understand as a project what the business needs, what fields go from one to the other and back and so forth and so on. Change management program is what we call a readiness plan. We have a change management procedure at the plant. The procedure, the change procedure is used as a baseline for our change readiness procedure. Readiness really means, is this power plant ready to go live with SAP? And it covers things from communication all the way through training to data conversion, etc. And it drills down to a section level, very detailed level of planning. So the temporary procedures that we had revised it just recently to reflect a new go-live date, it requires each section manager to have a readiness plan, which is quite detailed, as I said, to a task and an individual and a date. It also requires that each section develops a team. So it becomes part of their daily work to get the section ready. The reason we do this at a section level is because various sections have different needs. You know, supply chain will have needs that are different from operations, different from maintenance. So each one of these has a team and a plan. We set expectations in our procedure for what the plan has to contain. So we just don't leave it open that each section can do their own, you know, what they feel is necessary. We gave them a framework, we gave them templates, and we work, you know, side by side with each of the departments to create these plans. We also established 7 checkpoints. And so the checkpoints are at various times throughout the countdown to the go-live date, and they require that the sections accomplish certain things, certain milestones. We take those checklists. They're essentially a self-assessment on a targeted level that are done at the manager of the section, reported up to the director, and fed into the project. We track these as you would an outage milestone, okay, with, you know, feedback to the plant, so on and so forth. And any time that there is an area that's yellow or red, it's like you would in an outage countdown, we require an action plan from them. So, kind of the key points around the readiness plan is we use what we feel Diablo Canyon is very familiar with. Procedures, very familiar at Diablo Canyon, action plans that are specific and detailed to a certain event or a certain deliverable and an individual, that kind of thing. We also use our self-assessment program at a frequency to validate that the readiness plans and the checklists are coming across and that we're at where we think we are. We just finished one of those in April. Okay. So again, we're using familiar tools at Diablo Canyon to implement fairly new and you know, very new software for the plan.
Before you leave that slide, are you leaving it or are you still on?
I was about to, but there was one other thing. Go ahead. And this was a 2005 activity to map all the processes, then to identify changes that were needed and desired in the processes. Then we built an SAP. So as part of readiness planning, each section is responsible to go back through the processes that were designed, frequently by small teams, and validate that the process will work, understand what, you know, how they're going to manage it in the future. That can look like a tabletop exercise where we actually walk through the process step by step. It can look like, and this has been done commonly in maintenance, it looks like a big flow chart that the folks walk through and say, okay, now, Furman, we're at this step. What are we going to do? And list the very detailed activities. So it causes the station to get down into the actual task level, day-to-day work of what's it going to be like in the future. And that was a piece of our section readiness plan. That's how we drove that to happen. That has to then be followed up with training. So the training starts out with a process flow chart in the front. Very first, you know, for a student, here's what the process that you're working in. And then as we go through the training, we refer to various steps in the process. And we do compare the old to the new. We went through a fairly rigorous exercise in comparing current state to future state. And we call them change impact assessments. And then we've held and will continue to hold change impact forums. But it's a fancy word for sitting down with all the people that do the work and say, here's how you do it today. This is what the future looks like. And we're at the point now where we can actually demonstrate it in the software. So we've progressed far enough so that we can show them on screen demos. So that's a major part of the change management. It's built into the program, built into the policy and the procedure.
When you say this is what the future looks like, I'm a little confused. When you did the process mapping and you did current and future, is it future vis-a-vis how the software will work, or is it future vis-a-vis the ideal process with the process improvement strategy attached to it? Which is it?
It's a mix of the two. Process was designed and what we really want to happen, and metered by what the software can do.
Do the people really understand the connection between the process work that you're doing and the nature of how that software is driven?
Yeah, what we did, the build for the design of the whole process is to first train an SAP, understand how it works with the capabilities, and go look at the current way we do business and our current software, current procedures, and then build the to-be state based on the capability of the software, and in some cases, capability that people didn't know even existed. So we have to start them down the path of what's possible and then build into the Diablo Canyon processes, the nuclear steps, the requirements, and so forth. So that's how it's done. And occasionally it's bounded by the capability of software.
And Seth, that'll make SAP work for us.
We agree. They have to understand how the process works end to end. It's very important. And that's part of our training. And it'll be part of the demos that we do over the next several months and capitalize on this next summer, the time that we've got to show folks at a very detailed level what they're going to be doing and how it fits. how their work fits with others.
Is this the point where you have to convert reams and reams of old data into new data?
Yeah.
In order to support this?
That's right. Yeah. We're doing it now. Yes, it is. That has to happen before we go live, and it is literally tens of thousands of bits and bytes of old data. So when we start up the system, we'll have data such as your inventory, all the component data, component history, those kinds of things will all be there in the new system, you know, as they were in the old system, so that the work can continue. Very important, extremely important piece of the project to make sure that data comes across and is useful.
And from what you said, I gather you've done COBOL programming that allows you to convert some of the COBOL into what?
SAP.
SAP can absorb?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yeah. So an example would be today's field has numbers and letters. In SAP, it's only numbers. So we have to find out how to convert it. We've found cases where two fields in PIMS equal one in SAP, so they have to be combined and combined appropriately. That kind of stuff. And each field, each piece of data has its own set of requirements. So it's that level of detail that we work through. It's a major process. So one other thing, Ken, don't hit that yet. The last piece of our checklist and the last piece of our readiness plan builds into an approval to go live. So what happens is we bring through all of the months leading up to the go live, various checklists, how we're progressing towards being ready to go live. At the end of checklist number 7, it rolls up to a request for approval to go live by our officers. So that comes forward from the directors through the project sponsor, Jude Fletterman, up to Donna and Jim for approval to go live. The reason we do that is the checklists provide the basis for that decision so that we go forward with our eyes open and we know how much we've done in terms of training, data conversion, etc., so that it's a thoughtful approval to go live.
You want to talk about your contingency plan? What if most of it's ready, but some of it isn't? Mm-hmm. What if you can't really go live on that date?
Need to go.
Is there any corporate influence in this project at all?
Yeah, we cooperate with the corporation. So at this point in time, we're providing the corporation, the utility, with the designs that we've come through in the last year and a half. We're about 6 to 8 months ahead of some of the business transformation initiatives. So what we're finding is that as we've solved problems in SAP, we're feeding that into the utility, and they're using our work to build on. So the influence is both ways. But at this moment in time, it's flowing north.
I'm drifting back a little bit, I guess, to the approval process. And having asked the question about corporate involvement, is there also a corporate approval?
Yes.
There is.
Good question, yes.
And that would be in the form of who?
It's Pat Lewicki. Pat is our chief information officer.
Okay.
And she's signatory to our go-live. There's also a number of approvals you can imagine with Sarbanes-Oxley compliance and so forth that we go through at a lower level in the project.
Mm.
And we have a person that's full-time in San Francisco integrating our project with the other business transformation projects. So
what's the Sarbanes-Oxley requirements do for you?
Essentially, it requires that we have processes that are approved, right? That the processes, the new processes we create, are in compliance with Sarbanes-Oxley requirements. Okay? So there's a review and approval process through Sarbanes-Oxley Group, and that happens as we go forward through testing and finally through go live. So yeah, there's a whole department that handles that in PG&E.
So this department scrutinizes the contents of Sarbanes-Oxley. And then tells you it's okay or no go?
Scrutinizes how we've designed it, mm-hmm. the documentation and the process we use.
That you're conforming to Sarbanes-Oxley.
Correct, and then make sure that we're in compliance.
But they advise you as to whether you're in conformance or not.
Yes, yes. They're the overcheck.
So there's a great reliance on their ability to make sure they tell you the right thing.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Yeah, and reliance on we have on project folks that are very familiar with Sarbanes-Oxley. So, it's both ways.
That's amazing that anybody is totally familiar with Sarbanes-Oxley.
I don't know about totally, but it's a major piece of the project to make sure that we're in compliance. So, it's important. That's obviously not a slide, but that's in the details. Approval for
going live. One last question. The chief nuclear officer does not get in the approval circuit or does?
Yes. Mr. Keenan, Donna, and Jim approve for the site.
So basically, I have that approval, and what I've done when we decided not to go live, I took that recommendation to Jim and the team of directors we have.
The training that we develop is specific to Diablo Canyon. So we build it in the project. We have several folks that are full-time training developers. It's created around our business processes. So as I said, you'll see the first couple of pages in every training course to be a process flowchart. We also include a large number of job aids and training aids as we roll out the training. ESOMs, we've got cards that we've printed in the back of the books for the folks so they can pin them up on their whiteboards or put them in binders and so forth as a reminder. We do have computer-based training as part of the project and part of the ESOMs rollout. It's typically used for a basic level of understanding that you build on in future classes, so we don't rely on that for the very detailed training that people that are very, very extensive users of SAP would have. We are using it for a test in ESOM. So when you go to class, you go back into CBT and actually take a test to check your understanding. Most of the training that we do is classroom on system. Very, very little of the training that we deliver for the plant is not on person on keyboards. So we've got nominally 20 to 25,000 hours of training for the project. You see it's a huge amount of time. Small classes, about 15 people per. It's about what you get. And each class is structured with three instructors. Person up in the front, a person, you know, showing using the system, and a person roving to help people understand and help with questions. It's extensive. We also have a training environment. So when we do start training next year, we'll have a separate environment, a separate system that people can go in and play with. So when they go to class, they can come back to their desk and run through what they learned in class, and we expect to be giving them homework assignments that they can work on every week as we go forward. The training evolution takes several months, so we want the folks that go to training in the first few weeks to be fresh when they actually go on the system. So that's some of the elements of the training plan.
Physically, where will your headquarters be located? On-site?
The training we expect to be done on-site predominantly. There could be some overflow off-site, so we're working on it.
But basically, you're going to use the existing training building.
Yeah, we expect to.
Are you going to keep a development team over by the airport?
I have a few folks, but by and large, the project's going to move to the site. So most of the folks that are on the project team now become trainers. So if we're not working through the final parts of going live, you'll be out at the plant doing training, and after training we expect the folks to go back in their departments and become, we call them super users, but the people that are on, you know, in the department, you know, right inside the sections, that'll help the folks with questions, and have a helpline too for the initial
stuff. This touches everybody, and so part of our requirement is that we build this into what we call our 12-week look-ahead work schedule. And so when we come out with our training schedules, we integrate that with what our work schedule looks like so that we're only identifying work to be done in the plant that we have sufficient resources. So you'll know that you have resources that are going to be scheduled for training over a series of weeks. So there is a large impact, and the way we've looked to mitigate that impact is by adjusting work in the plant during that same training time frame.
So it sounds like you're not worried. You've got a plan.
We have a plan.
Okay.
Still a little concerned because it's a big impact, but we have a plan.
Right. Okay, thanks.
Finally, change management communication pieces. We found that the readiness plans were the best way to encourage communication at the section level and the supervisor foreman level at the plant. So we've created some requirements in our new revision that require detailed planning, detailed dates and times within each section. It could be a section level meeting, it could be supervisor level meetings. The project is there to deliver the content, any of the material that they need for a presentation, to be with the foreman, the supervisor, the manager as they present and talk to their groups, to answer questions and so forth. But we're encouraging the line ownership of the project to start here in the communication area early on, a year ahead. And we're seeing very early good results in this pushing line ownership of the project. Multiple delivery formats, you'll see on DNN if you've been at the plant today, a countdown to ESOMs go live, we're at T11 and then T10 and some of the things that happen. So that kind of an approach you'll see when we go for SAP as well. Email, current times, articles, but again, we're really most effective when we talk eye to eye in small groups. And our team is very proud of what they've done, so they want to go and demonstrate the software to their work groups. And so we've had great success. Just before the outage, we were just getting to the point where we could show the system. It was done to the point where you could use it. As we go through the summer, that'll be much more prevalent. That again, at small work group levels, small bites, hour at a time kind of a thing. We also use a self-assessment. We did one in April about the effectiveness of communication, and we've built that back into some of the communication planning that we've done to go forward for our June the 30th date. So we'll continue to do that self-assessment as we go forward and check the plan, see how our communication is doing.
Does Pierre Dubay work with you on the communications plan?
Yeah, we're working with Pierre and Arlene. Possibly can. Any other questions?
So June 30 date go live about a month after outage 1R14. So you'll have that outage behind you, and the next outage doesn't start until February, so you'll have a pretty convenient window in there.
That is why we selected the permit. That's right.
Okay. 1R14 dates are when from?
1R14 runs April 30 to May 30.
Is 14?
That's 1R14.
Is that the steam generators?
No, steam generator starts the next outage, 2R14. And then 1R15 would be unit 1's steam generator. So pretty good timing there, I think.
Yeah, it seems like it fits.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Appreciate
it. Any other questions for Charlie?
What physical computer does this thing run on? Is it here station? Is it
It runs in Fairfield, California. It runs on servers that our corporate office runs on. It's backed up in San Francisco.
Okay.
And of course, it runs on your desktop computer. We've got both microwave and fiber optics.
So you're depending on the system to run. How much say-so do you have at Fairfield as to system crashes, getting things back on? How much control do you
have? Great question. We will have a service level agreement with the corporation for their support of Diablo Canyon. That's yet to be written, but I can expect that they will honor what we need. I don't see that to be a problem. They're very eager to bring Diablo Canyon into the SAP use. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it is yet to be done.
Did you say you will have a bank of servers out here too?
No, not in today's plan. It'll be backed up in San Francisco.
What about backup power? What if there's a serious problem in the Bay Area?
Yeah, we're going through right now a business continuity planning exercise in case there's a major problem where we can't do a disaster recovery. Disaster recovery is nominally 2 days, similar to what we have today.
2 days is a long time.
This is beyond that even. So that planning is going to go on for the next several months.
Well, you remember the 89 earthquake, there were places out 4 or 5 days, and some big ones were out for a long time. This station could be a very vital factor in getting the power back on all over the place. And are there modules?
I would guess also, this is more of a question, that your Fairfield computer operation has some kind of backup diesel generator power or some other kind of backup power.
Well, I would think so too, but this could be a transmission, area-wide transmission crisis. And the power they have at Fairfield wouldn't do you any good if you can't get the information here.
Yeah, let's do a check, because I thought there was an uninterruptible power supply, and I don't know what was supplying that battery, diesel, what it was. But we'll follow up on that, and if you want to check on that during the next fact-finding,
I wonder, Charlie, can you give me any feel for the size of the load you're talking about if you needed to have emergency power?
No, I can't. But we'll follow up. If you want to come up for a fact-finding, we'll go through this with you.
Early August.
Yeah.
I think part of Dave's question was not the power, but the transmission of data from Fairfield to the station as well.
Sounds like it's got microwave, though. So you've got microwave and fiber optic. You've got some diversity and redundancy.
Yeah, yes, and that's important.
That's right. Which we have.
But, let's put that on the agenda for that.
But that fits because you also have to have that sort of communication infrastructure for your transmission system anyhow, right? So you actually use it for the general purpose for PG&E too, if I understand from our trip to visit the substation up above the plant.
Any other questions for Charlie?
Down here?
No.
Charlie, thank you very much.
Thanks. We'll see you in August.
Or earlier. Next presentation we have is a review of our LARA performance for our most recent refueling outage. And here with us today is Jeff Harker. He's our LARA manager. And Jeff accepted this challenge probably back in February, early March.
January.
Okay, January. Thanks, Jeff. When we recognized that we had a significant gap to go in where we were with our collective radiation exposure. And we wanted to put more focus on that. And Jeff stepped up, accepted that challenge, and is here to talk about the success we had last outage. And we still have more to do going forward. So, Jeff.
Thank you. As Donna mentioned, my name is Jeff Harker. I'm the LARA manager at Diablo Canyon. It's a new position, and I have to admit, I'm pleased to be able to make this presentation to you today because it is a true success story. So let's get right to it. Okay, so obviously, outage scope has a huge impact on what your dose, collective dose ends up being at the end of an outage. So if you look at your slide, nature, so I've combined them together there for about 12 REM. The fuel assembly split pin modifications, that ended up being almost 10 REM also. Steam generator photogrammetry walkdowns, that was estimated at almost 9 REM, and that is talking about the work that was done, the data gathering, this particular outage in preparation for the first steam generator replacement outage, which will be on Unit 2. The polar crane modification, that was a major upgrade to our polar crane, which is the one that supports all the heavy loads in containment, almost 6 REM there. And the 10-year reactor vessel in service inspection, that was estimated at 2.6 REM. So again, a lot of collective exposure there anticipated from this project work.
Jeff, the polar crane.
Sure.
Polar crane's way up out of the containment. I'm thinking radiation fuels are pretty low up there. What's the reason for that?
You know what? The answer for that actually applies to most of those items there, and it wasn't significantly high dose rate fields, but it was an awful lot of man hours in those locations.
Okay.
So.
Absorbing very small amounts of radiation?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the next slide shows how we got to the goal that we had. If you add the 38.8 up with the dose that we estimated for all the routine work, that took us to about 129. And it was about that same time that the LARA focus became, it became a focus item. The plant identified 6 areas that we wanted to focus on hard this year in our journey to becoming the best plant in the nation. And this was identified as one that we still had some room to improve in. So when we looked at that 129, we knew we were going to have to make a pretty significant step change to get to where we wanted to be. So we discussed it, and in January, late January, at a leadership meeting, we agreed to 100 REM for a goal. Everybody who was present, all the managers and directors, officers, all agreed to support that fully, to do what they could within their groups to meet their portion of the goal.
Do I remember correctly that that was the same goal you had for 1R13?
Yes, it was.
I thought so, yeah.
Yes.
And the date you set that goal was, you just said?
I believe it was January 20th. It was a Friday.
Okay. Close to that.
Okay. Okay, so from the generation of the goal, obviously we need to have some goals in a change management plan to help us get there. So we sat down and put a plan together, and the 3 main goals of that plan are listed there. The first thing was we wanted to make absolutely sure that everybody on ownership, but basically we were looking for the first line foreman to talk to their crew before they went into the RCA each time in their tail boards and ask them, what's your expected dose for this particular entry, rather than for the job, because the smaller you can make that, the further you can break it down, it's much easier to internalize it as an individual and see what role you have in that. So first thing was, what's your expected dose for that entry? With the increased awareness, people would be focusing on it more in the RCA also. Do I need to be standing here, or can I go stand in that cold area and wait? We saw a lot of examples of that being put into place. And then the last one would be the foreman getting back with the crew when they come out of the RCA and follow up with them to see, how'd you do? Did you come in under your goal? Did you experience some problems that we need to know about? Or did you learn something positive that others can benefit from? So it would help close that loop. And then the last thing was, we wanted to present some tools, better tools than we had previously, to to help the individual supervisors and managers manage the dose that was assigned or allotted to their crews. And we were able to do that also. So those were the three big categories that we were looking at.
Did you get a lot of good innovative input from the craft? Did that really pay off in the long run?
Yeah, we did. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, specifically.
Jeff, that reinforcing of our performance, have you gotten to the point in your line ownership that individual workers will see another colleague working and correct him or her on the Laurel practices?
I did not myself see any examples of that, but I heard that there were people who did see that, yes.
No.
The last time I went in and did an observation in containment towards the end of the outage, I was only in there about 15 minutes, picked up zero millirem, by the way. And I identified four examples of people doing exactly what we want them to do. The crew would go, or a portion of the crew would go in to the higher dose field, leave the other portion behind, they'd go and get the information they needed, then signal for the remaining guys to come up and help them. We saw examples of people specifically choosing low dose rate field areas that were identified as cold areas to wait in. And I also saw several instances of people going out of their way. One individual, it was kind of humorous because I'm at the point where I'm getting ready to come out of containment, I'm waiting to walk through the personnel hatch, and it's closed at this time. So because the reactor head is up on the stand, the dose rates in that waiting area are higher than normal, so we have a temporary shielding wall up there. But you have to stand in the right place for that wall to be effective. So I was in that spot waiting, and this other individual came.
And we were standing with the supervisor on the job at the time at one end of the pool, looking across and watching him work at the other end. We were standing there for a while. An RP came over and said, how about continuing your conversation in the lower dose area? Oh, okay. And we picked one out, and then we're told, yeah, that's a lot better. And so we left the edge of the pool and went back over and decided to complete our discussion.
That's the kind of coaching that once it's internalized within the culture, that buys huge dividends, and we were starting to see that already this outage. Okay, so we had those three goals, but we're going to have to break that down further into individual activities if we want to accomplish those goals. So the next slide shows some of the highlights of what we focused on. And it's also important to realize that we didn't put all of our eggs in one basket here. We tried to attack this from multiple fronts. And we were able to achieve success through each one, and then cumulatively the success was significant. The first one was the communication campaign that I talked about. That was intensive, to say the least. We had every meeting out there that we could think of to communicate to people, all the supervisor alignment meetings, the all-hand communication meetings, global emails, the Diablo News Network, Current Times, Plan of the Day, posters all over the site, all kinds of... I was intrigued this time because there were some really unique messages on these signs about different ways to reduce dose, different ways of thinking about it, and I got a lot of feedback this time about a couple of them in particular that, you know, it was interesting enough that it caused people to stop and actually read the sign and understand what the message was and then take that to heart as they moved on. So the poster campaign, I think, was very helpful also. We, like I mentioned before, we had brainstorming sessions with the craft. There were instances where I myself sat down with a bunch of radiation protection technicians, and we took information from them about ways they were aware of that we could reduce dose that hadn't been implemented yet. We also had, for a couple of months prior to the outage, every Friday morning, we had a burrito breakfast brainstorm. So if you came down to the cafeteria in the morning, we'd buy you a burrito, and you could either talk about issues that you were having with reducing dose, and we'd try to help them with that, or that was another opportunity for them to solicit or submit ideas. So we got some from that also. And the other ones came from the ALARA Incentive Reward Program. That's another bullet down there. Because I didn't want people to not submit ideas because they would think to themselves, well, I don't have the silver bullet. I don't have the idea that's going to save a REM, so I won't submit it. So we set the threshold very, very low. We got over 400 ideas submitted. And like I said, there were no big hitters in that list, but every one of them was significant in that it got those people to start thinking, oh, you know what? there is a better way to do this. And typically, it would be related to the job that they specifically were involved with. And it came from people, all groups across the site. So it was very, it was gratifying to see the way the people bought into that. We also benchmarked two utilities before this particular outage started. We went to Seabrook Station and we went to Three Mile Island. We chose those two specifically because Seabrook has historically had very low outage dose or very low dose outages, typically 40 to 50 REM air range. And Three Mile Island, their most recent outage, they achieved some significant success also by implementing a couple of new ideas that they hadn't done in the past. And they had primarily to do with the way they were shutting the plant down, water management and how they shut the plant down. So we tried to bring some of that back with us. One of the interesting things at Seabrook was to see how clearly their culture across the site had adopted the philosophy of ALARA. We had we stopped lots of people in the hallways and just talked to them briefly for a few minutes at a time, and they were committed to it. It was interesting to see that. So that obviously is what we're headed for ourselves. We also contacted IMPO and requested an assist visit from them regarding the shutdown chemistry plan. Sent them a bunch of information, they reviewed it, and then we had a conference call with them, and they basically said that our plan is sound. They could not offer anything that would help us, that we could put into place prior to 2R13 that they thought would be significant. So they said what we had in place was good, so we were glad to hear that. We rolled out the new daily dose report. I talked a little bit about...
One yes. question. Did you have a CRUD burst when you shut down?
I'm sorry, what?
Did you have a CRUD burst when you shut down?
Yes, we did. We anticipate one. In fact, we want to have one.
Big, small?
I believe it was a smaller, slightly smaller magnitude than the previous one. So, yeah, we anticipate one. In fact, we want to have one. We want to have it in a controlled manner so that we can effectively deal with it.
Sure.
Because if you don't force it, you're going to get it later anyway, and you're not going to be able to deal with it.
That's why I wondered what the size was. Okay.
How long do you need after you get that until you get...
We also restricted most of the jobs in containment. We had the RC, the reactor coolant pumps, turned off, but we still had some cleanup going on with the RHR pumps. So, yeah, I guess you could say about a 36-hour period, and then we were back to where we wanted to be again, actually a little bit lower.
Did you have a big fight about that with the outage management?
No, actually we didn't. There was a high-impact team that was formed before the outage, a multidiscipline team, and obviously ops and outage management were part of that. And everybody they had the opportunity to explain their point of view, and in the end, everybody came to an agreement that that was the right thing to do. There was some talk initially about could we potentially reduce the runtime with the RCPs and still basically have the same benefit? And it was determined that no, we did not want to do that. So everybody agreed with it and we moved on. The last two bullets there basically go together. This particular outage, we focused real hard on providing options to having to build scaffolding to get up into the overhead to do work. Historically, if you needed to get up really high, the only way that you were going to get up there was to have scaffold built for your job. So scaffolding is pretty dose intensive because it has teams of people going in and you have to put it up and you have to take it back down again. There's no way around that. So this particular time, we had a lot of emphasis, a lot of support from the scaffolding crew, the people that work as PG&E employees, the guys that came in for the outage, the foreman in that group. They did a fantastic job. And they came up with some ways that we could get people up in the overhead safely and not have to build scaffold. One of those was we bought longer extension ladders this time, 24-foot ladders, which allowed people to get up and do certain inspections and valve IDs, that kind of thing. We also used a device called a teletower, which is a mobile, small scaffold platform that you can move from one place to the other and then hand crank the platform up to the elevation that you need it. If you can't get it to the spot you need it by rolling it, it's also very quickly torn down and then put back together. So that was a real benefit. And that was actually something that we saw at Seabrook, too. So that was another positive from that trip. And the last thing that we did that was impressive, I thought, and not seen something this neat before, was we purchased some telescoping cameras. I believe they had about a 20-foot extension on them. So again, it allowed people to get their eyes up into the overhead to do the inspection, if that's what their job was, without having to get their body up there too. So because of that, there were some instances where people would not use it. If they had to get up, if the camera pole would have to be extended fully, they felt, because we did some testing with this in a non-radiation field out in the turbine building, and we had a big group of people come watch it, and some of them saw where they would be able to use it during the outage, and others said, no, it's not going to work for my particular application. So it wasn't a cure-all, but it definitely was a pretty unique piece of equipment.
What kind of dose fields were you avoiding?
Typically, well, it was a huge range, to be honest with you, yeah. But I would say for the most part, probably 10 millirem an hour up to maybe 200 millirem an hour. Okay, next slide. So was all of this effective? We put a lot of effort into this, but what did we find, or what did we end up with? The cumulative exposure for 2R13 was 74.158 person room. Significantly less than even the 100, and I don't mind saying that as we entered into this outage, as we were communicating the 100, we advertised it as a very aggressive but very achievable goal, and there's no question there were some disbelievers out there. But as we moved on through the outage and they saw the success we were having over lots of different areas, they became believers too, and ultimately we ended up at the lowest outage dose ever in the history of Diablo. So certainly a success there.
Percent-wise, that is a fantastic reduction, percent-wise.
It is. It's not too far away from 50%. Another very positive observation was that we also saw that people were taking it to heart conscientiously, not going into the RCA if they did not need to, because when we compared similar scope from the previous Unit 2 outage to this Unit 2 outage, we saw about 5,000 fewer RCA entries and about 5,000 fewer man hours in the RCA also.
5,000?
Yes.
To what do you attribute that? That's a pretty big reduction.
Primarily the awareness factor. Yeah. People were really bought into the concept of taking it to heart internally as an individual and trying to figure out ways that he or she could actually reduce their own dose or come up with an idea for the team.
So give you a couple of examples there. There were places where we may have staged people in containment as a contingency or backup and found that you could stage them right outside the hatch and they were not in a radiation field, but yet they were available to do something if they needed to help us with ACS you individually, and you can see how your own performance can make a difference. And so I think with Jeff and some of his communication through all levels of the station really helped raise the awareness to make that impact.
Thanks.
Was there a reduction in the planning stages of the work packages to reduce the number of personnel needed for each job? Was that an effort?
That was one of the things that we talked about, right? Typically, it would apply more to the jobs that routinely had bigger teams, like scaffold erection, that kind of thing. And those guys did take it to heart. Actually, everybody did. I was not aware of anybody who did not look at that conscientiously to decide, okay, is this the right number of people we sending in, or are we actually sending in more than we really need? It was all about rethinking the way we've done things historically. You know, we're still trying to get the same job accomplished, but we're trying to come up with better ways of doing it more efficiently.
Yeah. That 5,000, what percentage reduction does that represent? The containment entries?
Roughly? About 10%.
And I would like to add one more example, because we have talked about ensuring that we have individuals properly trained and qualified, and sometimes you might think, oh, well, somebody isn't going in that may need the knowledge or experience. And what we saw in many cases is you could go in and still get the knowledge and experience and yet do that in a lower field. So depending on the scope of work, you may be doing the same type of work in multiple locations throughout the containment. You could go in and do your training or your orientation in a lower area, lower dose area first, and that helps you when you go to a different area. So it was a way of looking at it, and I think the individuals internalize that and use tools such as that to help out.
Yeah. I have one other example. Before the outage, I was talking to an individual who was going to be on their reactor disassembly team, and he was talking about the need to be right at the edge of the reactor cavity so he could look down and watch the work unfolding and learn from that. And he thought that was a great thing because he said, you know, I don't have to be down right next to the reactor head. I'm saving dose by being up at the cavity edge. So this whole focus was, again, about getting people to rethink, kind of break through their paradigm, basically. So I said to him, okay, well, that's great. However, take it one more step. Go out of containment and see if you can watch what you need to on the cameras, because we've got a lot of cameras set up around the cavity. We watch a lot of the big evolutions remotely. And when I said that to him, he stopped for a minute and thought and said, yeah, I guess I could do that. So again, just getting people to try and rethink what they've done, you know, the same way they've done it. Year 29, the goal was 100. Full points would have been achieved by finishing the outage for 84 person REM. We came in at 74, 158, and first quartile cutoff was 70. So we were only about 4 REM away from it. Previously, we had been, Unit 2 was sitting pretty low in the second quartile, and once this outage is factored in, we'll be very close to first quartile. So we effectively shifted it almost a full quartile as a result of this outage. So I'd like to pull it together and just say that for me, this was a real good experience, and it showed me, again, what kind of results the team can have out there when we pull together and focus on a common goal. It's tremendous.
Questions for Jeff?
How are you going to carry that to 1R14?
That's a very good question. That's what I'm working on right now. Obviously, there will be some different things. The goal is to get processes put into place so that it doesn't rely on having that huge campaign at the beginning of the outage. We want to get people to focus even now on reducing their dose by 1 millirem at a time when they go in and do online work. Typically, the online work is nowhere near as dose intensive as an outage, but if they can get those types of habits to be more ingrained during the online period, when the outage comes around, it'll be much less of a process to get it moving there also. So in answer to your question, that's what I'm looking at right now. Some of the things that we're going to be doing are going back and looking at those ideas that were suggested and see which ones of those couldn't be implemented for 2R13, but we do have time to roll them out for 1R14, that kind of a thing. Basically taking lessons learned from this one and incorporating them into the process.
Well, they showed what they could do to improve it. Just keep it up.
Right. It's creating mindset.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have any questions.
Yes. In a couple of outages, then you'll be replacing steam generators, which is a much larger amount of time and work required. Does INPO treat that differently, or is it? You're going to take a hit because you are doing major capital improvement. In that case, then, what are the strategies to minimize dose for that type of work, which is less familiar?
Well, I'll put it first in perspective, and from what INPO looks at, since they're part of who evaluates us, they do recognize that if you have something like a steam generator replacement, there is going to be a change in some of the indicators. And so it's an explainable reason why an indicator may change.
Every one of those was put on a schedule. And they looked at the schedule, they took into consideration the system dose rates at that particular time. Is that the right time to go in that location and collect our data, or should we wait 24 hours? They looked at the impact the system was going to have on when they went in, incorporated that into the schedule, and had tremendous success because of it. So one of the things that I anticipate happening with the generator replacement would be they would be driving towards that same type of schedule, scheduling everything down to the smallest activity, because that's really, if it's all laid out like that in black and white and you've taken into consideration ahead of time when the dose rates are going to be low and you're not going to impact another work group in that area if you go in there, then that's when you're going to get your major bang for the buck, is the planning up front.
Do you have any known high CRUD locations after you've completed a CRUD burst? Well,
specific
on a rather
locations?
Repeating basis, it will be at a higher level there than elsewhere?
I can't think offhand of any place that is readily accessible that has that kind of a situation associated with it. There are some areas that are already treated as locked high radiation areas that are very, very infrequently accessed. Some of those areas, you may see that type of a slow increase, but nothing that I can think of that would impact the typical work activities in containment.
Well, going from typical to something non-typical, with respect to Pat's question, do you have any of those known areas in the vicinity of the replacement steam generator work that you could deal with in advance?
Not that I'm aware of.
Carl?
Bill, you finished?
Were you done? Or you got more?
No, that's
you thinking?
Well, yeah, you heard me.
I couldn't hear it.
I'm good. I'm good right now.
Okay.
Ron? And on that same subject, replacing steam generators and looking ahead, replacing heads, those will further lower your outage doses.
Right.
Have you looked at kind of quantify what that might look like? You're at 74 now. Without having to do those inspections and all that whatnot.
Right. The primary steam generator inspections won't be done every outage. The disassembly and reassembly of the reactor head will be much less dose intensive because of the integrated aspect of the head itself. You have to take less apart, put less back together. Right off the top of my head, I don't have a good number for you, but I would guess in the low tens of REM.
Okay. They've also got a ISFACI, or used fuel storage yard, like you're building now. And they have, I've forgotten the numbers, but they've determined that their highest non-outage dose comes from transferring used fuel to that facility. That's their single largest non-outage dose. So
okay.
Might be something Laurel asked to look at in that respect to keep that
right.
low as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks.
I guess following up from Donna's comment, would it be correct to assume that many of the plants that are in the top quartile are ones that have replaced steam generators?
That is true for some of them, yes, definitely.
Any other questions or comments?
Yeah,
from Jeff?
It's my turn now. As you know, I have great concerns about some aspects of Alara, but what I've heard today is a very good example of the best practices and the best approach to Alara. My problem is not with Alara. My problem is with collected dose as an indicator, and we get back to management by indicator every time. We are, as you just pointed out, the steam generator project coming up. We're getting into the point of diminishing return on collected dose. And when IMPO finds that it has to adjust plant after plant after plant because of things that have to be done, there's going to be an awakening at IMPO that the idea of using collective dose to rank plants in quartiles as if collective dose represents a good Alara program is going to have to change. And it's something that I've been lobbying for quite some time, but not with any success. I pointed out in these meetings before that NRC no longer uses collective dose as an indicator. And I would assume that in due time, INPO will back away from it as well. I would hope they would do it right away because it really doesn't say anything. And the reason they use it is because it's so simple. It's a simple number. And you're ranking plants by quartiles and hitting them on their performance based on an index that doesn't have real meaning. And yet, it's a motivator. And as a motivator, I think it's a very valuable thing. This is what you've demonstrated today. So, just on collective dose when it's already so small that you have to explain why it's different from what the general feeling of collected dose is, because you were doing an important job. So that's my speech, and I think I'll keep banging away on it. But I certainly want to make sure you understand that I'm impressed with what you guys have accomplished this time. And that program, I know, has been active since January or before because of the importance of it as an indicator. And I just hope that the motivation will be there to keep it important, whether it's an indicator or not.
And we agree, and I think Jeff would even tell you that when we talk with our folks about the importance of it, what really hits home is that it's about planning our work and thinking of our work and doing it efficiently, and not the result that says it takes you to a different quartile, but really looking at how we do our work and do it the best we can. And that will stay no matter where those numbers are, where that quartile is. We believe if we approach it that way, we'll continue to drive to where we need to go.
And I think that's the way to do it, and that's a challenge to management. I think the stakes are high. You're going to have constant awareness that the number of millirem of collective dose is not a valid reason to cut any corners on safety, and that's going to take another education program.
We agree with that. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
Great, Jeff.
And I have our last presentation for this afternoon, and it's to review organizational changes. It'll be the high-level organizational changes at the station. So we'll go ahead with that. Next slide. Some concepts behind our organizational changes, and just to let you know what we're looking at. First, when we look at our director team, we're really looking and valuing cross-organizational experience. And when you look at someone who was here yesterday, Ken Peters, what he brings as engineering director, he also has a background not only in engineering but in licensing, in corrective action, in performance improvement programs, and outage management. You'll see that too with one of our other directors, Ken Langdon, we brought on. He has a background in not only outage management and work control, but also in operations and maintenance and in training. So we really value that type of cross-organizational, cross-functional background, and we're looking to internalizing different concepts, being able to challenge the organization in different ways. Internal candidates do bring the experience, knowledge, some of the history you need to have to blend with that in order to make changes going forward. So we value having a cross-section of that. We also are looking at making moves to help us with what we call our operational focus, which brings operational experience, and by having a broader background allows you to really focus on the plant while working in another area such as engineering or our performance improvement programs. Next slide. So talk about changes we've most recently have. You met Ken Peters yesterday, our engineering director. He's got over 24 years of experience in the nuclear industry, 17 in a leadership position. We talked yesterday about some of the breadth of background that he brings. We recently filled our site services director position. You met Mike yesterday. And with site services, what I really saw there is somebody who believes in process improvement, who believes in the client satisfaction piece, because that's kind of the role we have in site services. His background in supply chain management, also his work with the rest of the company when we went through our plan of reorganization several years ago, he really has that kind of strong focus. When we talked about Nexus and we talked about using the change to Nexus to really change the way we do business, Mike grasped that. And when you go through and have a chance to look at what we're doing with our supply chain, we're really changing and simplifying how we're doing procurement at the plant and using SAP then to model the process we developed. And it was his buy-in to that. It was his acceptance. And, in fact, he brought most of his supervisors over to work on that team because of their experience in supply chain to help develop that process. So he really brings that kind of process improvement and client satisfaction. We've also filled a new position, a director position. It was our engineering director. You may remember Steve Chestnut. It's a position that we filled for interfacing with the company from our transformation efforts, as well as looking at how we gain and improve performance from areas such as our strategic reliance on STAR, so strategic teaming and resource sharing, and also USA, Utility Service Alliance, the agreement we have with other power plants. He is our interface with that. We felt that by putting somebody in that position at a higher level in the organization, he has a broad understanding of how we do business. He's going to be able to help capture areas where we can improve, not only from the other power plants that we interface and STARS.
We'll do STARS?
That's correct.
How about other national interactions?
Depending on what it is, we may use him to do that as well. So I first want to get him in and get his feet wet and understand his role, especially with transformation and how we can best interface. But we'll also be looking at any other interfaces that come up.
Who will he be reporting to?
He reports to me.
Donna, this is an offline question, but every once in a while I think of it. What's Diablo Canyon's relationship to EPRI nowadays?
So we're a member of EPRI, and we participate in most of the committees they have, especially in materials reliability program. So there are separate committees that they have focused in different areas. We've talked steam generators. We have one of our steam generator engineers is on a task force with EPRI. So we have involvement in multiple levels of the working groups up through the Nuclear Power Council.
Thank you.
Okay. Next slide. Also, what we've done, it's effective now this week when we prepared the presentation, it was in the future, but our operations director, which had been Paul Roller, has moved over to our performance improvement director, and really bringing that line organization, line ownership of our performance improvement plans and being able to lead that through that organization. So we're really excited to have Paul move over to that position. And then also our outage management director, which is Ken Langdon, we'll be moving him later this year to our operations director position. He has a broad background. He's really brought strength in our improvement for outages and aligning safety and schedule discipline and bringing him over to get some broader experience at the station. So he'll be transferring over in October.
Is the performance improvement director a new position?
We've had that position for several years. So that's where learning services reports, regulatory services, corrective action program, management observations, all of those performance improvement programs all report through the
PM. Who was in that position before Paul?
Stan Kettleson was acting in that position, okay. And prior to that it was Chuck Belmont.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
And go to the next slide.
How does Cary Harbor fit with that position now?
So Cary Harbor is the manager for performance improvement, so he has the program owners reporting to him, and then Cary reports to this director.
Yeah, right. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
Then with this operations director position being open for a period of time, safety and direction that they're headed. So we're really excited to have him come over in that role temporarily as a developmental role. And then he'll stay on as an assistant to the operations director, helping him with some of the day-to-day type items for operations, as well as looking at getting Steve some more experience to prepare him for a director position in the future. So it's a developmental role.
Will he be assistant to the director or assistant director?
Assistant to the director.
Assistant to the director.
That's correct. And then for our outage management director, when Ken Langdon comes over to operations, it will leave that position open. So we are looking for candidates for that position, and he'll be filling that and naming that before he moves to operations. We'll be using a selection process that includes panel interviews, as well as we use an outside company, Personnel Decisions International. It's a company that helps assess management and leadership capabilities. And we'll be using that information together to make a selection for that position. So we'll hear a report out on that later this year. That concludes the changes in the organization. Other questions?
Yeah. What about the VP and general manager position?
So the position that's open since Dave Oatley retired in March, and Jack Keenan, our chief nuclear officer, has stated that he's looking to fill that position within the next 3 to 4 months or so, so later this year. And Jim and I have been working with Jack on how the best way is to go about filling that position.
Are you using an executive search firm?
You'd have to ask Jack that.
Okay.
Other questions?
I had some, but they're not related to organizational changes. So when you're ready for non-org change questions, I've got a couple.
Well, let's see if there are any others. Firm?
No.
I have none. So, Bill, you're
I think we're ready.
Free to go?
Okay. I wonder if you could comment at all on the status of your INPO mid-cycle review.
Sure.
I guess that's Belmont's bag. He's, I think, running that.
Right. He's helping pull that together. Actually, the lead for that mid-cycle assessment will be Ken Langdon. We thought that would be a really good opportunity for Ken to get some experience, and he will be a host peer on our evaluation team next year when IMPO comes in. So just to make sure we're clear, we call it a mid-cycle assessment, and what that means is that it's a mid-cycle between IMPO evaluations. So we're about halfway between our IMPO evaluations. The team, what we're doing is actually mirroring an IMPO evaluation. In the past, we've typically brought a team of on-site friends, areas that they wanted to target the team to look at. The team is now meeting this week to set up their assessment plan. And then we will have a two-week assessment. It includes 10 off-site peers as well as about 10 on-site peers. And we'll go through a process that just mirrors what we would do for an IMPO evaluation. And we believe by strengthening this process, it will really help us identify areas that we need to target and focus and work on and take that ourselves and work on it ourselves.
I'm personally pleased to see that you're utilizing so many external peers. I think that's certainly going to give you, hopefully, a much better shake at
exactly
at where you are and what you are. Yeah. The second question I had, maybe I'm not trying to put you on the spot by challenging you with things that aren't on the agenda, but I couldn't help but notice in reading a PSRC meeting minute document from April of 21 of 06, and it, you were attending that meeting. It was reviewing startup with gagged main steam safety valves, and I don't have any disagreement with the outcome. I guess you could help me if you could answer this question. When you gag an MSSV, do you declare it inoperable?
That's a great question, and I'm thinking through our process for doing that, because if it was gagged, then it would not be operable. But I tell you what, I would like to validate that statement before I commented on it, so I'll check on that.
I'll tell you the reason it caught my eye. If, in fact, you do declare it inoperable, and I think your words were, if it's gagged, it's not operable. Normally, when you take a piece of equipment or a system that has been declared inoperable, you do a post-maintenance test of some type on it. Now, in this case, it was concluded by the PSRC that no PMT was required.
That's correct.
So that's what got me into the operability versus inoperability assignment, if you will, of that. I would appreciate it just for my own satisfaction, I guess, as to what we've got on our hands. Oh, you don't have it on your hands. You've already made a declaration, but I'm just curious how you got there.
Sure. We'll do that. We'll follow up.
The last I had, and this is something I'm sure you're familiar with, but I think it's should be of interest to anybody in the oil moment, so state.
Yep. So we have given that thought, and I am participating on that executive task force.
Excellent.
The reason for that is we think that with the communications and the public interest in California, there's much to learn for the industry. And so that task force is actually comprised of not only plant personnel, but there's communication personnel, government relations personnel, and they hit a cross-section of the industry from the very large fleet plants to individually owned plants like Diablo. So we think it is important to be involved with that and help guide the structure and guidelines that are going to be developed.
Well, I'm very pleased that that's your answer. I think it's a very positive answer. And I think it would be extremely valuable in your situation here with respect to maybe improving interactions between you and the community.
Exactly.
It certainly sounds like a vehicle to be able to do that.
We agree.
Okay. I thank you very much.
Welcome.
That's all I have. So.
Anybody? Anything more for Donna? And I have nothing more. Donna, thank you for tremendous support during this meeting. Now, before we adjourn, we have a couple of committee matters that we'll have to deal with, mostly concerning scheduling of fact findings and so on. And I was going to ask those members of the public who are here, do you have anything that you would like to say to the committee or to Donna or anybody else? Okay. All right, then you're welcome to stay while we worry about schedule, but you don't have to because Kent can bring that back to you.
Okay. Thank you, Don.
Rather than taking a break, let's us
yes.
just
try and finish off what we have to do.
Keep going.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay. Sheila, we talked briefly yesterday.
Thank you.
And this fact finding that I'm trying to schedule for August 2nd and 3rd, is there any chance you might be available even for one of those days? Or is that is not going to work?
I don't think so. I'm not available to the end of August. I can double check and see if I can move something around, but my availability is really the end of August and in September.
Okay.
I'd love to do it.
Yeah. What have you got in mind for your next fact finding?
September.
Early, late?
Just let them pick a date. I'd let he and Furman pick whatever date's available for them. They don't have a date.
I can't understand.
I said, let Bill and Furman pick out whatever date's available for them. I don't think you need to tie a date down.
No, I was just wondering what you were pointing toward if you had an idea.
I guess I don't have anything.
Okay.
Well, I shouldn't say that. The last, I wouldn't be available to do it the last week of September. So I guess that's part of a shrinkage program.
Oh, that's okay.
Let's get the members' availability first, and then see how we can schedule consultants to fit. Pat, what do you see as your next?
I'm going to have a little bit of a complication for travel coming up.
Yes, I would imagine you would.
Our third baby arriving, so because of that, I'd prefer to defer my fact findings and do them in the following period. Let me explain what I'm thinking of, which is that we do want to have a fact finding associated with the evaluated exercise that's coming up on October 25th. And that would be 1 week after the public meeting, so it would be slightly after the public meeting rather than coming before. And then, if possible, I'd like to do a second fact-finding then out in December. The week of the 11th would fall before the holidays, but after the last day of instruction for classes at Berkeley. And so if perhaps maybe the 13th and 14th of December could be a second one. But that would push it out, just doing the fact findings a little bit later.
That would basically give you 3.5 fact findings for the year.
Yeah.
And that's good because the observing day is a half day if you have to limit your visit to that, which is maybe okay because of where you're located. August 2nd and 3rd would be my third for this year, and travel gets difficult for me after that anyway.
I'll do one in November.
But I would have had three by then anyway. And Bill, you're thinking you might be able to do
I'll
one?
Do.
Third and fourth quarter.
Well, if you don't go with me, then that would point toward Bill's September date. So why don't you talk with Sheila about that, Bill, and see if there's a way that could be arranged. And or since our
why don't I do this? Why don't I communicate with Sheila and Sherman?
Yeah, that'd be great.
And see if we can resolve date and make it go that way.
And I think we have the resources to support two consultants if it seems appropriate.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Okay.
The numbers,
and Perry, why don't you follow up the same way for October and December?
Okay.
Well, I think that gets us that far. Now, we should pick a tentative date, at least for planning purposes, for our June public meeting of next year. And 1 hour 14 is scheduled to end the end of May, and it could trickle over. Kent, any preferences as far as June next year? Do you know anything about the plant?
Nothing more than you mentioned. Just allow yourself enough time to put that out.
Maybe towards the end of June, say the week of the 18th or the week of the 25th.
Well, look at Wednesday and Thursday.
Yeah, so yeah, 2021st.
Have we already set a date for the first public meeting? In the-
we have a tentative date of January 31st, February 1st.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah, I remember that discussion.
I guess so.
It's, you know, it's early enough so that if there's a contingency, we can do something about it. But in principle,
January
that was our
31,
tentative.
You say?
January 31, that should be Wednesday.
Yes.
I didn't remember that either.
No.
Yep.
Now
that
they remind me, I do.
Okay. And what are you suggesting
Rob, Furman,
June?
Either of you have any thoughts on dates that we need to take into account?
No, you mentioned the meeting dates.
Unless there is, let's go with that date.
Next year.
2021?
June 20th, 21st.
We have to celebrate your anniversary the night before. Maybe we can get the clips.
Yeah, it's going to be pizza time. It's not supposed to.
Yeah. It does.
You can always celebrate it here, you know.
Well, that's what we already did.
That's right.
So
that's right.
We made it this year.
That's right.
Wait.
Yeah, you have to bring that for meeting with you again. There
we go. Are we supposed to add these?
They're supposed to just pass them down. If you would. Take a couple.
We have one already. No, we don't. Pass that down to the kids.
Feeling out his fundamentals. That's what we need, the back to basics syndrome.
Okay. Is there any other business?
I might just mention, had received directly from the tour, Jim brought three comments, and I've got 17 more. So we received a total of 20 comments. They're very interesting, and I'll what we'll do is we'll compile them because I think they'll be of interest to the committee members.
Yeah.
Some of them are they'll be of interest and very pleasing to PG&E as well. And it looks like most of the people, I'd say a good 2/3 of them, indicated they want to be added to our mailing list. So it's a good, that was a nice
Rob, why don't
nice
we
effort.
Compile those comments and make a quarterly report next time, next public meeting.
Right, good idea.
Yeah, but fire them out as an email to us before that.
Yeah, I'll have Denise go ahead and prepare them from these sheets.
Okay.
Firm. I'd just like to remind all of those who are writing the annual report along with me that the first drafts are due to me August the 9th. And I'm getting thumbs up signals from the two other authors. And that means we need to get our fact-finding meetings, Jim, updated quickly and out to the other two, Sheila and myself. Thank you.
Okay.
Can I ask Kent, what is this document? Could you, should I pass it on or make it available to the members? And
That was forwarded by our news media from the people who took filming of the last tour.
Okay.
So it's
okay.
From be used from any way you want.
From the tour, then.
I'll
yep.
Okay.
So that's right.
Great.
When we have the
okay. Great. Okay. Good. We'll make it available.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the only conflict.
Do I have a motion for adjournment?
Move it.
Second. Professor.
Oh, second. Sorry.